The final case for oral argument this morning is Tim Detta, appellant versus Patty McGee's, Inc. Appellee for the appellant, we have Mr. George Nelson, attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellee, we have Mr. John Nooney, also an attorney from Rapid City. Mr. Nelson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson. May it please the court, opposing counsel, Mr. Nooney. I'm here on behalf of my client, Timothy Detta, who was an innocent bystander in a restaurant and establishment in Rapid City during the late evening hours, March 9th, 2001, and into the early morning hours of March 10th, 2001. This case was brought by my client, suing Patty McGee's, the establishment, based upon premise liability. The client was injured on the premises of Patty McGee's and sued Patty McGee's for its negligence, failing to secure my client's safety while he was on its premises. This case went to trial on June 5th. It was a three-day trial, June 5th, 2007. During the trial, evidence was presented indicating that my client, at the time of the stabbing, him being stabbed, was on the second floor of Fatty McGee's, where close to midnight, the bar in the establishment was promoting a liquor giveaway. And how this worked was that at midnight, and it became known that the patrons expected this, the bartenders would get up on top of the bar and they literally pour shots into the patrons' mouths. This was to promote their business. It was during, just prior to this, that my client was standing next to Ray Bledsoe, a friend of his, who he had worked, a co-worker, who he had worked with, and while talking, another gentleman, Dustin Hunter, had approached the bar, and there were words between Mr. Bledsoe and Mr. Hunter, which led into an altercation between those two individuals. There are some questions as to how many punches were thrown, but there were punches between those two individuals, and there was a struggle. During that struggle, or maybe even prior to the struggle, it's uncertain, Mr. Hunter was able to signal to Willie Guerrero, a friend, or I believe it was a brother-in-law at the time, to come forth and to be present when he was arguing with Mr. Bledsoe. As Mr. Guerrero came forth from a distance away, he brought with him a beer bottle, and he hit Mr. Bledsoe over the head with that beer bottle. At that point, my client, Mr. Detta, made a motion. He raised his arms and made a forward movement. But the testimony during the trial was that he saw Mr. Bledsoe get hit over the head, and that it was a natural reaction to make a step forward in the effort to get in between Mr. Bledsoe and Mr. Guerrero. As that occurred, Mr. Detta, my client, was stabbed in the neck. The stabbing cut the jugular vein. My client was seriously injured, although at the time he didn't know it. He thought, I think later in the trial, the testimony was just that he thought perhaps with his blood he was shot. He wasn't sure. There was no evidence presented during the trial that he was aware of how he got injured.
Was there testimony that anybody saw him being stabbed in the neck? Or is it possible that broken glass from hitting the other guy over the head flew into his neck and cut him open?
I do not believe there is any such testimony presented in the case in chief by the plaintiff or by the defendant.
But there's no testimony as to somebody seeing him stab him.
That's correct. The other principal witness at this time was Megan Thorpe, who was a friend of Mr. Duda's, who was talking to Mr. Duda prior to the fight between Mr. Bledsoe and Dustin Hunter. She testified that she saw Mr. Guerrero come forth, and I believe she testified also that she saw him hit Mr. Bledsoe over the head. And it was at that point she turned around to leave. The jury went out during the deliberations of approximately 7.5 hours. There were 4 questions that were raised by the jury. They were presented to Judge Trimble. Judge Trimble did not contact either side, either of the attorneys.
Had they left their numbers to be contacted?
Yes, Justice Sabers. And this was during business hours. This was between 10:30 a.m. in the morning and 5:30 in the afternoon. After the jury came in, verdict was rendered. The jury was discharged. Counsel were packing up to leave the courtroom. Judge Trimble informed me that there were 4 questions the jury had asked. And he suggested that I could take a look at them. He didn't think there was anything there. So after that, obviously the plaintiff appellant here, on his behalf, I filed the motion for a new trial and a judgment notwithstanding the verdict. My motion for a new trial was based upon errors the appellant believes were committed during this case. I'd like to first address the issue of whether or not the trial court should have granted my motions for directed verdict on the issue of contributory negligence and assumption of risk, whether or not the trial court should allow those instructions in this case. First of all, contributory negligence, there was no evidence presented in this case that my client was a co-combatant. Nothing to indicate that he participated in any struggle or altercation. My argument before the trial court was that there was no evidence of any negligence on the part of my client during the time he was on the premises.
Now, my understanding is the jury never really reached that issue. They just went to assumption of risk and that was over?
That's correct, Justice Meyer Henry.
So we don't know. They didn't even get to that issue.
No, they did not. Nonetheless, I believe their instructions that were used.
The decision that they made was based on assumption of the risk. So if we were going to reverse this, we would have to say for sure that the assumption of the risk instruction was improperly given. If we say that, do we even need to get to the contributory negligence issue?
I agree, you do not. I think the facts are very specific on the issue of assumption of risk, and that being that there is such an absence of any indication of any evidence that would show that my client, Mr. Duda, had actual constructive knowledge that Mr. Guerrero still had in his hand a broken beer bottle. Then not even to say the fact that there's no evidence to indicate that if he did have such an item in his hand, that he would use it, and he would use it against my client. Nor did he.
He's stepping in the middle of a fight. He's not getting in the fight, but he is trying to intervene to stop his friend from getting hurt. He knows that there's already been an object used as a weapon against his friend. So you're saying that he has no reason to know that another object or the same object could be used against him?
Justice Cunningham, the defense did not bring out any evidence, any testimony to indicate that he had such knowledge. And this is an affirmative defense. The defendant, Fatima Gies, had the burden of bringing forth such evidence. No such evidence was brought forth. counsel for Fatima Geese could have asked Mr. Duda, did he see whether there's a bottle or a broken bottle in Mr. Guerrero's hand?
But he did see it. He did see his friend get hit over the head with a bottle.
Correct.
And the bottle broke.
Correct. However,
no one had been stabbed, though, with this bottle. There's no evidence that anybody was stabbed except your client.
That's correct.
Well, we've said in other cases that these are generally jury questions, and I think the word is except in the rarest of cases. Why is this one of those rarest of cases?
Because of the elements for assumption of risk, the three elements, and the lack of evidence of there being lack of evidence of any of those elements. Again, there's no testimony indicating that Mr. Duda knew that Mr. Guerrero still had a broken bottle in his hand. Secondly, if we assume that he knew, there's no evidence that he appreciated the risk that the bottle in Mr. Guerrero's hand could be used against him prior to him making a movement to intervene between the two, Mr. Guerrero and Mr. Bledsoe. And lastly, there's no evidence that such movement was voluntary on part of my client. I think there is evidence just to the contrary, that there were no other alternatives that Mr. Duda had at that time. And plus the exception, I think, presented by this court, the Mack versus Crans Farms, in the event that there's no reasonable alternative in order to avert harm to himself or another, assumption of risk cannot be found. So if we assume that Mr. Duda had actual knowledge that this broken beer bottle was still in Mr. Guerrero's hand, and if we assume that he had actual constructive knowledge that Mr. Guerrero would use this broken beer bottle against Mr. Duda, and that knowledge was because there was a history between the two individuals, or Mr. Duda had witnessed Mr. Guerrero hit somebody before or stabbed somebody before, even if we assume that, and also if we assume that Mr. Duda appreciated that risk, the third element, whether or not this was a voluntary act on the part of my client, is in dispute. There's no evidence that this was a voluntary act. If we get to that third element, if this court has to get to that third element, and it rules that this was a voluntary act, it, in essence, the court would be saying that Mr. Duda assumes the risk of being injured, and he has no recourse against the premises for its liability, for it being negligent, because it assumed the risk in a situation where he had no choice. And the
well, he kind of ran out of the bar.
Excuse me, Justice Chief.
He could have ran out of the bar.
That is an argument. I don't believe facts bear that out.
What do you mean? I mean, it's a free world. You could run out of a bar if you wanted to, couldn't you?
This was a situation close to midnight. This area of the bar was congested, extremely congested. There's testimony during the trial that approximately 15 feet away, there were two law enforcement officers. Yet, neither one of them saw this fight occur. And so, the option of running away, again, I do not believe was available. And does this court want to issue a ruling that says that he should have ran away, when what he did was to avert harm to Mr. Bledsoe?
Don't we support the jury verdict? The evidence that favors the jury verdict?
Well, I think...
You're asking us to throw out, you had a right to a jury trial, and you're asking us to throw out a jury verdict, aren't you?
Yes. Yes. I believe that jury verdict was faulty. First of all, the jury did find the bar, the premises, liable. They allocated 10% fault to the bar. So it was evident to the jury that it had done something wrong. It did not provide security at this time of need from our client that it should have provided. 21 employees on the premises at the time, 9 of whom were security personnel. The second floor of this establishment was so crowded that none of those security personnel were able to stop Mr. Guerrero. I'm not saying that they were obligated to stop the first fight, but they should have been able to intervene prior to Mr. Guerrero arriving at the scene with a beer bottle.
And I presume you made that exact argument to the jury.
Well, I understand it's factual. I mean, that those arguments are factual. But after close of evidence, Justice Zinter, there was an absence of evidence showing that my client assumed a risk. And so I moved the court for a directed verdict on those instructions, whether or not those affirmative defenses, assumption of risk and contributory negligence, should be permitted. This court has ruled in the past that if there is lack of evidence, those instructions for those affirmative defenses should not be given. Miller versus Bacon Park Inc. and Dotson versus South Dakota Department of Human Services, two examples of cases where this court has ruled that instructions for those affirmative defenses in a negligence case were not appropriate and reversed the trial court.
When you say absence of evidence, you're talking about he didn't see the beer bottle and that type of thing, right? Is that what you...
That's correct, Justice.
Well, you know, the rule of law is assumption of the risk, not assumption of the facts. You don't have to know all of the facts, because if a reasonable person knew all of the facts, they wouldn't act. They wouldn't assume. So there's some risk involved here. And it is, I mean, wasn't it sufficient to let the jury decide this?
Well, it does.
Because there's a huge risk in interceding in a bar fight. And you don't need to know that they have a gun, that they have a knife, that they have a beer bottle. I mean, you don't have to know every specific before the doctrine or the rule of law is applied, do you?
But there was no evidence that he had actual constructive knowledge of even the risk. If I understand your question.
Of a risk that you could get hurt in a fight?
Well, easy question from the defense attorney. Mr. Duda, have you ever been involved in a fight? And I believe there was that question during his deposition, and Mr. Duda is not has now such disposition to fight. Those questions should be brought out during one's deposition, during the trial itself, and it's not the plaintiff's obligation to bring forth evidence or lack of such evidence. And it also raises another interesting question as to what was the assumed risk. Was the risk that Mr. Duda was supposedly to have assumed the risk that this establishment with 21 employees, 9 of whom were security personnel, were not going to be able to come forth and intervene and stop Mr. Guerrero before Mr. Duda got stabbed? Was that the risk that he was supposed to assume? There is no testimony even to that. And so it's not, the plaintiff's burden to bring forth evidence on affirmative defense such as that.
You've argued, if I've heard you right several times, that there was no knowledge of an actual constructive notice. Now, actual notice is one thing, constructive notice is another thing. Do you actually mean both, or in one sentence, or are you talking about a new type of notice here that we're not aware of?
If the claim is that he had constructive notice, that after seeing somebody get hit over the head with a beer bottle, that a patient should have constructive notice that you're going to get stabbed because there was one violent act, I think that's very attenuated. To assume that there is going to be another violent act and it's going to be committed on you, and it's going to be of the nature that this was. Again, without there being any prior evidence, testimony from my client or anybody else that Mr. Guerrero had a propensity to commit a violent act. In fact, there was testimony just to the opposite. Mr. Guerrero had never committed such an act on the premises prior, that he had been on the premises before this incident, and that the bar had kept a list of patrons, known named patrons, who did create problems, and that he was not on such a list.
Your time has expired, Mr. Nelson. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Nui, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Nelson. I'm here today asking that this court affirm the decision of 12 jurors from Pennington County, June of 2007. Just to add a couple facts, which I think are important to understand the case, to give us some perspective on the case. The case involved a claim that my client operated a facility, and they negligently operated it in that the bar was too loud, it was too crowded, too dark, and that case went to the jury.
But you missed the fact about how they're pouring free whiskey down people's necks.
Well, Justice Hodenkamp, there were some questions during the course of the trial as to whether or not that evidence, if that really was a fact that occurred or not. There were some allegations about that. There was a lot of suggestion during the course of the trial that these events are happening, but they really, whether or not that actually happened is suspect, I think, at best. But after this case was brought, Fatty McGee's turned and did what they are allowed to do under our Code of Civil Procedure, and they brought a third-party action against Willie Guerrero, the individual that was the perpetrator that busted the bottle over the gentleman's head and ultimately caused the injury to Mr. Nelson's client, Mr. Duda. After this case went to trial, the jury was asked to fill out a special verdict form, and one of the questions that they were asked to apportion the fault between the parties. And one of the questions that the jury necessarily had to be asked is whether or not there was any assumption of the risk. And after the jury reached that question, then for all practical purposes, the verdict form was signed and the case was completed, because the jury was asked whether or not there was an assumption of the risk. As Chief Justice Gilbertson said, the questions of contributory negligence, proximate cause, assumption of risk, those questions are in fact questions for the jury, except in the very rarest of situations. And I think if you look at a few of the facts that were evident during the course of the trial, it is apparent that the affirmative defense of assumption of risk was properly given to this jury. There was specific testimony from Mr. Duda's acquaintance, Megan Thorpe, that she was standing in the proximity of the location where the gentleman got into a scuffle and the beer bottle got broken. She testified that after seeing what had happened, she turned to leave the scene of the situation because she was scared, she was nervous, she was frightened. But that fact in and of itself lays the foundation for the basis that other individuals had the ability to judge the situation, make a determination, and leave. A question was asked, did Mr. Duda have that same opportunity? And there was some suggestion to this court that he did not have that opportunity. In fact, Mr. Duda had the exact same opportunity that his companion, Megan Thorpe, had after the situation broke out. He could have, if he had wanted to, turn around and leave the situation.
But also, with assumption of risk, you have to appreciate the danger. The danger here that he would have had to appreciate was that he could get stabbed. How would he have known that? What evidence did you present that he had the ability and the time and... My recollection is everything happened so fast, and nobody testified that they saw that he was stabbing anybody with this beer bottle.
Well, Justice Meyerheim, I think what the plaintiff in this situation has to appreciate, he has to appreciate the risk. And let's take
the risk of getting stabbed.
The risk of getting injured. I mean, the risk because...
Well, all right, risk of getting injured.
He had to appreciate the risk of getting injured. He is standing in a bar. He sees two gentlemen throw fist and hit one another. He sees a gentleman come across the bar with a beer bottle and smash it over the head of one of the people in the fight. He made a conscious decision at that point in time to intervene into a fight that was going on, that people had been punched already, people had been beer bottles smashed over their heads, And there had to be an appreciation that he could himself suffer some injury if he stepped into that melee, so to speak. He told his doctor, which was part of the evidence that went to the jury in this case, that he was injured when he tried to break up a fight. Well, when a person breaks up a fight, that is evident or obvious, I think, that you have or you run the risk that you also could be injured. And the question that we're really here to ask today is, should the instruction or should the affirmative defense of assumption of risk gone to the jury? And that's really what the question is. Because the jury is the one that has to make that determination. And except in the rarest of situations, should that defense not go? There was a factual basis for it. We saw the fight. Other people appreciated the fight. Other people left. The jury, the 12 people in Pennington County, were the ones that had to make that decision, and they made a decision and found that, yes, there was an assumption of the risk, and under our law, that means that Mr. Duda had no recovery.
What about all these questions that the judge answered without calling in the attorneys and giving him an opportunity to object?
Well, I think if we look at what the trial court did in this situation, Justice Meyer Henry, and you look at the four questions that were asked of the trial judge, I acknowledge that typically a trial judge will call counsel in. He or she will share with the counsel what his or her answers are going to be, and then the answers are given to the jury. That did not happen here, and I acknowledge that's somewhat unique. But if you look at the law of South Dakota, before the law was changed on July 1 of 2006, or any time thereafter, this court has previously said, and I want to acknowledge this, before the law was changed in July 1 of 2006, that it may be error per se not to involve counsel in those processes. But then the question comes down to, was there any prejudice? If you look at the questions and the answers that Judge Trimble gave in this case, I think at most you could say his answers were benign.
Well, one of them did deal with the assumption of risk.
Well, Justice Meyer, I don't, all due respect to the court, I don't know that it did. The fourth and final question that the court was asked by the jury, the question is, what is the definition of a known risk? They did not ask what is an assumption of the risk, because that would have allowed Judge Trimble just to refer them back to instruction number 23. They asked what is a known risk. And Judge Trimble defined a known risk by saying it's a risk that you know about. I mean, he really didn't answer a question for them. He just gave them a very kind of runaround kind of answer, so to speak, and told them it's a risk that you know about.
But isn't that the problem?
That's a substantive answer. That's not like the other questions. Defining that is a really a substantive issue, isn't it?
Well, I don't think it is. I think it's what other courts have described as administrative directive, I think is really what it is. It's like saying, what is a dog? Well, a dog is a dog. I mean, he did not tell them anything other than he answered the question with another question.
But you've tried enough cases to know what it's like settling instructions on defining a dog. Their two sides are going to have two different opinions on how you define it. And you're going to argue that out. And you should have a right to express both views of the law as to how you define that dog. And then submit the question to the jury.
Well, as this court has said so many times, when you look at questions of instructions, we look at the totality of the instructions all the time. And as I looked at the questions that were asked of Judge Trimble, one could ask oneself, well, what should the answer have been? Because he didn't really answer the question. And so often what trial judges do, and as this court is well aware of, when a jury asks a question, what does the trial judge say? Go back and read the instructions. Read instruction 20. Read instruction 21. So they put it back upon the juror to make that decision anyway. Known risk was not an instruction. It was not an instruction that the jury had been given. They'd given an instruction on assumption of risk, but not known risk. So Judge Trimble gave them kind of a roundabout answer, so to speak, without really telling them anything. And the jury then ultimately made a decision that there was an assumption of the risk. But I think if you look at the totality of the questions, there was no evidence that there was any prejudice caused here. And
but doesn't it kind of play, and there's an old axiom that whatever happens to you in a bar, tough, you got it coming. And here, you've got assumption of the risk, and the jury is asking for some clarification as to how that applies in the facts, which is a bar fight, and all they get back in their face is assumption of the risk. What and counsel don't get any input into that, and we're supposed to say, well, all this, that's no problem.
Justice Gilbertson, if you look at it, they were not asking about instruction 23, which was the assumption of risk instruction. They were asking about a known risk. And I think that's a distinction, maybe a distinction without a huge difference. But at the end, there's no evidence that his response or his answer to that jury in any way caused anyone any prejudice. Now, I appreciate that Mr. Duda would have appreciated a more laborious response, take out Black's Law Dictionary and pull the definition out of Black's Law Dictionary. I don't really know that that was appropriate or necessary or would have changed anything. But if you look at what Judge Trimble did, and particularly in light of the fact that the South Dakota legislature changed the law in July of 2006, I don't know that there's a basis today, because I don't think this court has decided a question on this yet, of whether or not that...
You're not suggesting that the trial judge now can give a set of instructions after the attorneys have gone home and waiting for a jury verdict. I mean, doesn't it seem like common sense that if there's a jury question involving a question of law, and if the court is going to say, okay, I'm going to answer this question in some way, you've got to have the lawyers involved, whether there's a rule on it or not.
Justice Kohlenkamp, with us.
I know you're in a tough position, because if the judge had called you, you probably wouldn't have agreed to this either. Who knows? But so you're here defending the judge's actions that he did on his own. I understand that.
Well, I think there's a little bit of a distinction. There's a couple cases that Mr. Duda's counsel cites to, and the question where courts years ago would give instructions or not give any instructions except just articulate certain suggestions to the jury, or they give a whole new set of instructions. That's not what happened here. We have four questions. And if you look at the answers that Judge Trimble gave in this case, his answers were, I use the word benign because they just were. I mean, one of the questions was, who paid his bills? Well, we all know the answer to that. I can't tell you that. What's negligence? Read this instruction. You know, then was a question about the verdict form. Well, answer the verdict form the way it's prepared.
The problem is, though, with assumption of the risk, it's a far more, I mean, judges and lawyers get confused between contributory negligence and assumption of the risk. I believe Justice Gilbertson wrote that in an opinion. This is obviously a serious question, and they wanted to know the answer to it. What known risk? I mean, that is always the issue. What risk is known and assumed? And that's what they wanted to know. So how can you say this wasn't prejudicial to the other side?
Justice Martin, I think the way I would approach that would be the following. If we want to speculate, so to speak, as to what the jury was going through when they got to that particular issue, the jury asked Judge Trimble, what is a known risk? It's a risk you know of. Well, let's take that now and put it into perspective as to what the jury did. The jury then had to make a finding that this plaintiff knew what the risk was going to be if he interceded into that fight, which I think even goes above and beyond what our assumption of the risk instruction was, which has an actual, which is a known, and a constructive component to it. And if you look at it in some regards, I think Judge Trimble put the bar higher than it probably should have been when he defined it the way he did. And based upon that, that issue had to go back to the jury. It was a jury question in the first place, and the jury made a decision.
Do you agree with your opponent that the attorney's telephone numbers as to where they would be were given to the judge?
The court and the bailiff particularly would have had those numbers, yes.
Okay. And did he ever give any explanation as to why he didn't call the attorneys?
I don't believe that Judge Trimble ever gave us any particular reason why he did not bother us with those questions.
Isn't it kind of lulling them into a sense of security that's false?
Well, I must disagree with you, Justice. There's no sense of security when the jury's out for 7.5 hours and you pulling your hair out saying, what could they possibly be talking about for this long on a 2.5-day trial?
Well, I'm talking about the security of knowing that if something comes up, they're going to be called.
That's true. But having tried enough cases and had that call so many times when the judge calls and says, counsel, we have a question. And every time I've gone to the chambers to hear that question, the judge says, and here's what the answer is going to be. Like it or not. Well, I don't really like the judge, but, you know, we make a record about it. But it goes back to the totality of the instructions that the jury gets in the first place. It's not as if the judge, unless the judge is going to absolutely give the wrong law, for heaven's sakes. And there's cases from this court where that's happened, where the judge just gave the wrong directive. He missed the law. I don't think there can be any suggestion that Judge Trimble did that here.
Well, let's go to that question. That kind of follows up on what Justice Meyer Henry's been asking. You know, the jury was really quite perceptive here, because when they asked, does it mean that he knows he will get an injury, which is more specific than knowing there's a risk? And so that's really a question of law. Do you tell the jury that he had to have knowledge of getting an injury, or of just assuming that there's a risk of injury? What is the substantive law on that?
I think if the jury had asked this question, court, what do you mean by assumption of risk? And I think I'm relatively confident in saying that Judge Trimble would have, in that situation, said, go back and read Instruction 23, because he had done that on several other questions that had been given. But essentially, when you look at the question that the court, that the jury asked, I'm not really sure if they were focused on the assumption of the risk instruction, or they're trying to piecemeal it, so to speak, as to what they were trying to really ask the court. But the answer that Judge Trimble gave was exactly the right answer. What is a known risk? It's a risk you know of. I mean, how often do trial judges not really answer questions? Well, they don't typically ever answer the questions, because they're not really supposed to, because they might interject something into the jury deliberations.
They do that because they're afraid they'll get reversed.
Justice Martin, I don't want to say that, but you're exactly right. They always are concerned that if they say something other than go read the instruction or take the totality of the instructions, that you, Supreme Court, are going to tell them you can't do that. You're giving the jury something you shouldn't do, because in essence, then, you're rewriting the instructions after the fact, which I think Mr. Duda is suggesting that's what should have happened in this case, but we all know that's not the correct way to deal with this. We're supposed to tell the jury to go back and read them, give them some kind of a round, chase your tail kind of answer, but not really answer the question for them, make them go back and do the work, and they did that and came to the right conclusion. That was an assumption of the risk was a matter that was properly in front of the jury. The jury considered it. The jury read the instructions. The jury came to a conclusion that there was an assumption of risk and there was no recovery in this case. If you look at the other issues in this case, we've already touched on the issue of contributory negligence, and Justice Meyer Henry, you spoke to that already. That issue was never even addressed by the jury. They didn't have to get to that. We have talked ad nauseum about the issue of assumption of risk, and we've covered that. And the final issue that was raised in the appeal in this matter is whether or not Mr. Guerrero should have been a party to this case. And I think it's well established, there's no question that he should have been. There's a proper third-party pleading. It's irrelevant whether or not the plaintiff claims over against a third-party defendant. That doesn't have to happen. All we were asking the jury to do was to apportion the liability between us, if we had any, that being the bar, and Mr. Guerrero, the perpetrator of this situation. The jury did that in this case, and when they ultimately reached the conclusion that there was an assumption of risk, they returned a verdict in favor of Fatty McGee's. We would respectfully request that this court affirm that decision. Unless the court has any more questions, I will sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Nooney.
Thank you.
Mr. Nelson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. In response to Mr. Nooney's arguments, I'd like to, again, have the court focus upon the first issue we raised in the appellant's brief, that being whether or not the trial court committed error by answering jury questions without participation by the attorneys, the ex parte, sui sponte answers that the court had given to the jury. One of those questions dealt with whether or not it implied that the jury did not understand the instruction on legal cause. And it was proposed by a plaintiff during trial that legal cause is confusing, and proximate cause would be the most appropriate phrase to use in this case. And as I relate in my briefs, the reason for that is that we have a situation here. Mr. Guerrero is a patron who comes from a distance away, interjects himself into a bar fight, and participates in that bar fight by hitting somebody that's participating over the head with a beer bottle. And
that could easily be construed by the jury as an illegal act. It was an assault, a crime being committed. For the defendant to be allowed to say that the plaintiff did not show where the establishment violated any law creates much more confusion to the jury. And that's what was argued throughout the case, is that plaintiff cannot show with absolute, significant substantive evidence that the establishment was in violation of the occupancy level, the building code regulations, or any other rule or regulation that would indicate that they were, that would enable the plaintiff to dovetail onto a argument that by committing a law, that was the legal, or violating a law, that that was the legal cause for the negligence, and that that legal cause was present here.
But didn't the jury actually find that the bar was a certain percent at fault?
Yes, it did. The point being, though, that there was confusion by the jury, and not just on the assumption of the risk, but also the legal cause instruction. And counsel were not given an opportunity to provide additional input or make any objections as to what the court was ultimately going to do.
I thought that was taken care of at the settlement instructions.
I'm talking about the four questions that were raised.
But the definition of legal cause went into the jury as part of the court's instructions, which you were present at, whether you liked it or not.
Correct. I was contended by plaintiff that proximate cause would be more appropriate. If counsel had been contacted when this question came back from the jury during deliberations, I, on behalf of the plaintiff, would have been given another opportunity to impress upon the court the need to inject this instruction to alleviate any confusion. There not be any question that there was confusion on this. This jury was confused with these instructions. And the counsel, both sides, were not given an opportunity to try to remedy that or make objections as to how the court was going to respond to it.
But, of course, all that assumes that there is some material difference between legal cause and proximate cause. And we've never said that.
I understand, Justice.
If anything, our cases tend to suggest the opposite.
I would say this case might be an exception to that. Again, because of the facts. We have Mr. Guerrero committing an illegal act on the premises, and the defense, you know, arguing that plaintiff didn't show where any crime was being committed by or violation of law was being committed by the establishment, and versus what is really at issue here. The plaintiff has to show that a proximate cause to my client's injuries was the negligence of the establishment, its failure to provide security. After a fight had started, and this was, I appreciate your use of the phrase, Justice Gilbertson, bar fight. After a bar fight had started, but my client's response to that and my client's presence did not indicate that he was in a bar fight. He was not participating in the bar fight. And I would hope that this is easy to do, just to nonchalantly say, well, this is another bar fight case. This is not just another bar fight case. This is an innocent bystander case. My client is there when a fight starts and the property owner fails to intercede, interject itself with security, stop the fight before a third person comes in from a distance away and creates more harm. If that third person comes from a distance away to participate, security could have come from a distance away to stop anybody else from participating. Earlier, Mr. Nooney stated that my client had an option, an alternative. And Justice Sabers, you asked, well, couldn't your client just leave? Mr. Nooney uses the evidence that Megan Thorpe turned around. Well, she didn't leave, though. If you read the transcript or the cited transcript in the briefs, she was prevented from leaving because it was at that point security was coming. She was turned around again, and then she, you know, was still there. There's no evidence that she even made a step away other than she turned around. So it's questionable. I don't think the defendant has proven, provided any evidence, that my client could have left that incident. He was in a situation where a friend, Ray Bledsoe, a co-worker, was hit over the head with a beer bottle. He stepped in. There's no question that that he did that. He stepped in. There's a question as to whether or not he knew what was going to happen next, or that he could have appreciated what possibly could have happened next. The assumption of risk defense should not have been allowed. The trial court should have granted my motion for directed verdict on that. It would have left a case of where plaintiff is trying to show that the defendant, Fatty McGee's, was negligent in not arriving at the scene of the fight soon enough to prevent my client from being stabbed. That's the case. There is no assumption of risk. There was no contributory negligence. A client was not in a fight. He did not throw a fight, a punch, didn't touch anyone. He didn't raise his voice. And yet, the defendant is allowed to use that in this case, and it confused the jury. And that's why I'm asking this court to reverse the trial court. So it's an injustice to my client in that respect, and again, that his procedural rights were denied with the questions that were asked by the jury, and that his counsel was not allowed to participate in responding to those questions or objecting to the court's response. Unless there's further questions, I'm done.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Court will be in recess.